You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
You are going to love today's podcast. It's with John August, who is a screenwriter whose credits include Big Fish, Charlie's Angels, Go, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Corpse Bride, Frankenweenie, and Aladdin. He also wrote the novel series Arlo Finch and the book for the Broadway musical version of Big Fish. He co-hosts the Script Notes podcast with Craig Mazin, the creator, showrunner of Chernobyl and The Last of Us, and they have a new book. It's called Script Notes, a book about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters, though I think this book is interesting to anyone who uses storytelling in their life or their work. Enjoy the pod. John August, welcome to the podcast.
My absolute pleasure to be here.
So you started down this podcast road a long time ago, like 14 years, right?
Yeah, we're coming up on 15 years now. It's crazy.
Oh my God. Okay, so it's interesting. I was thinking about this. You know, my experience with your podcast was my wife was a listener. She turned our son onto it, who is a – and my wife is a teacher and a director and a comedy professor.
Great.
And then our son is an actor and a writer. And then he basically asked for the Audible account so he can listen to every back episode. And then a couple years ago, I jumped on the train here. And while you've had great success as a screenwriter, I imagine the podcast success is different in that it is so intimate in terms of the relationships. I'm sort of curious if you thought about that in these worlds that you inhabit.
It is interesting because generally as a screenwriter, every other year or something, you're out there promoting a movie, a thing you've done. But to have an ongoing relationship with a group of listeners who are tuning in every week, it's just a different thing. I listen to podcasts myself, and you feel like you have a relationship with those people because they're in your ears. I mean, podcasts are such an intimate thing that you feel like you know these folks. And sometimes it's really jarring then when you see one of those people in real life and like they don't look like you expect and they don't right. And like that voice is coming out of an actual human being. It's strange. So it's a but I've loved doing the podcast. It's like it's weekly therapy for me. It's a chance to talk about this craft that I love so much.
Yeah, that's same for me. And my dad was a radio guy for 33 years. So I also feel like, at different times in our culture, people had that experience with radio, which they kind of don't anymore.
Yeah, there's that, you know, it's a comforting friend who's there with you. And it's been interesting to learn just how many of our listeners have no interest in screenwriting per se. They don't want to be screenwriters themselves. They just like hearing us talk every week.
Well, okay. I wasn't even going to get into this at the beginning, but I will real briefly. So I don't know if you know, I mean, you know Second City, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But one of our biggest divisions is our corporate division. Mm-hmm. So we go in and work with these corporations because... And I'll tell you this, like when we used to tell them, oh, we're going to come in, we're going to teach improv, we're going to teach to play, they didn't want to buy play. Play was uninteresting to them. Yeah. However, they understood the value of improvisation because like, oh, we work without a script all the time. Can you help us with that? When I'm reading your book, I'm also like, man, anyone who wants to learn how to give better feedback, anyone who wants to learn how to tell a more effective story. And that, those are the things that we take into these businesses. So it may surprise you, but I'm telling you, having lived in that other part, no, this is like valuable to anyone who is in the industry of, let's just say this, engagement and persuasion.
Yeah. I think some of the podcasts I like to listen to the most, they are smart people talking about things that they know and they're having a high level conversation. It's a chance to eavesdrop on a high level conversation. So I'm not surprised that these executives that Second City is going in to talk with, they want to be able to talk at that high level and feel like they really are communicating effectively what they need to get across.
All right. So the book isn't linear. It's not necessarily meant to be read that way. So I want to start on chapter 18.
Please.
Notes on notes. This is a thing that we say at the Second City when we teach about taking notes, which is take the effing note. Mm-hmm. You don't have to use the note, but to argue the note is not going to be helpful for anyone in that moment. And understanding maybe what they mean by the note is more important. And these are all things you talk about. But first, what you talk about is you say, quote, it becomes hard to figure out where you stop and it starts. Mm. And that's really what this is about, because you're going to go into this thing maybe a little bit defensive because it's so important to you.
Yeah, it is. So the Notes on Notes chapter came out of two experiences. First, as writers, we were constantly getting notes. And so we wanted to have a conversation about like how to ingest those notes, how to take the note in Second City parlance. And at the same time, we wanted to have a conversation with the folks who were giving us these notes, because we felt like they could be better. Those notes could be better. Yes. Fundamentally, they could be. And so we went in and had a special session with about 20 or 30 different creative executives at DreamWorks and other companies, and just had like a really open forum about like, this is what we hear when we get this kind of note. Like, here are examples of notes that are actually useful and things that we can implement. And here are notes that are just like, they're going to throw us for a loop and we're not going to be able to process them. So it's both, how do you receive a note? But honestly, more crucially, how do you give a note? Because giving a note that will actually help the writer get to the next stage is so much more important than just putting something up on the scoreboard.
How were you received by these executives?
It was great. It was a great conversation. Okay. And obviously, it's self-selecting. They chose to come to this forum. But they understood, and they could also talk back to us about like the challenges that they face. Is sometimes they are giving notes that they themselves don't really agree with, but they're mm-hmm. a higher level. It's important for someone else for those notes to be there. There are times they give us written notes that have direct contradictions in them, and they kind of know that. And so what we're trying to communicate back is, at least don't gaslight us. At least acknowledge that there's a discrepancy, a conflict within this document, and help us understand why.
All right. So let's talk about advice for the note giver, because I think that is actually, let's just say this. When you talk about how to get the notes without dying, a lot of that is just self-regulation.
It is.
Breathe. Don't overthink it. Be dispassionate in your disagreement. You say be passionate in your agreement. Yeah. All stuff that's a little bit, if you were going into a negotiation, you would understand 100%. That. It's the same. Okay. So advice for note giver. Number one is, opinions are not facts.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that to the note giver so they have some humility in this note they're giving, right?
Absolutely. And so that understanding that an opinion is a feeling, and that feeling is important. And so we need to hear what it was you were feeling as you were going through this, because that reaction is important. That's all we're going for as writers, as comedians, is to get that reaction. So be honest with what that was, but your solution to it or your diagnosis of the problem may not be accurate.
Yeah. Here is my absolute favorite, and I've shared it with a bunch of people. You say, speak towards, not away. And then the line where you kind of describe it, you say, quote, writers don't know how to write away from something.
Yep. You can't write a negative. You can only write towards a thing. You can't, avoiding that, that issue isn't going to get you any place. It has to be like, where are we trying to get to, rather than all the thousands of places we're not trying to head. And so pointing out like, oh, that didn't work. Okay, well, that didn't work. But doesn't mean it's categorically that kind of thing will never work. Describe a future vision of this movie, this scene, whatever, that is successful, and so that you can get there together.
Yeah, that's a really – this is not – giving notes is an art, and very few people are good at it.
Yeah.
So, that's just true. I liked ask writers how they like to receive notes. So for me, that is, do you want them after the show? Do you mm-hmm. want them the next day? Do you want them in an email? Do you want them in, all those different things? Because if they can't hear the note is absolutely useless.
Yeah.
So how best for them to hear the note? And so I'm going to ask you, how do you like to get notes?
It depends on the project. But in general, I like seeing the email ahead of time so that I can sort of sit with it and process it. I will often honestly just get on the treadmill when I'm reading it that first time. So I can't sort of panic about it. But that way I can at least have a sense and a framework of, okay, this is the kind of meeting we're going into. These are the areas that have concerns. And then if I have solutions or pitches for those things, I can be kind of a little bit ready for it. The other times it's been fine where it's just like you're just having a conversation. That's not an issue. The danger of not having any warning going into it, I've come into some just like, I was just blindsided by notes where it's like, I don't even know that we're talking about the same movie. And that's difficult when you get an email, but it's just disastrous when you get that in the room, because it's like, I don't know what we're doing. I've walked out of notes meetings where it's like, I don't think there's a movie here anymore. And so that's why for me personally, I like the email ahead of time. Cause while I'm a ruminator, I can also, at least then plan a little bit about sort of like what I can do rather than, what that meeting is going to be like.
So one of the gifts I realized in reading this section, because one of the things you say is remember that rereading a script will make jokes less funny, which of course it's true. And I have produced scripted work, but primarily I haven't. So I produced here for 25 years, and the scripts show up at the end of the process after we're done because an AD has done that. So when you're not working from script, you are simply in the room seeing how laughs land each night, which – oh my God, what a gift. No one ever had to worry about that. You were just, the audience was telling you, by the way, is the other thing. So if you can have 300 people in every note session and they're going to tell you whether it's working or not, unfortunately, that's never going to happen in Hollywood, but it does happen in places like this.
Yeah. So the ability to get feedback and actually sort of know what's working with an audience is so crucial. I mean, don't get a chance to spend a lot of time with that in the book. Yeah. I will say that for the movies I've done with Tim Burton, Tim does not like to be in audience test screenings at all. He hates it. He won't go. But I will go because I love it. And generally at that point, I'm seeing the movie kind of for the first time too. I'm seeing this cut for the first time. And so I get to see like, oh, that joke worked. That didn't work. I get a sense of what the energies are like in the room. And I can be the person with like the biggest set of notes to the editor on the way out of that screening. Cause I could see it with an audience. I could tell them what was working. I could really feel what it was like with that group. So that's a really crucial part of the experience for me. One advantage screenwriters often have is that on feature films, maybe we're there through pre-production, maybe we started shooting, but we generally don't see everything that's shot. And so when we get to see that first cut of the film, our eyes are kind of fresh. We don't remember what a pain in the ass that actor was or how difficult that day was. We're just seeing the movie and we can sort of approach it with fresh eyes and see like what's actually working on screen and what's not. And then when we give our notes, we have to remember like, again, how do we like to give notes and how do we like to receive notes? It's thoughtful. It's honest about your reaction and it's proposing solutions that make sense within the context that are not sort of ragging on anybody, but pointing towards a vision of this next cut, which can be better because of these changes.
Is Tim Burton an outlier in that as far as a director who doesn't want to sit in a screening?
Every director is different. I think every director feels a little bit of panic and terror about it. Tim is specific because Tim is specific, but it's scary. I mean, anybody who's filmed anything, you cannot anticipate how an audience is going to react. And so that very first time you are nervous.
Okay. So let's jump into the rules of screenwriting. What's interesting is you start chapter one with these 20 rules of screenwriting, which I think I've seen around in other formats. And you note that all these rules are BS.
Yeah, they are. Okay. And I think there's an expectation in any book about screenwriting is going to have a formula and a set of rules. And so we wanted to sort of get that out of there right in the start. And there are things which seem sort of common sense, but are actually just old tropes that need to go away and die. Things like never saying we hear or we see, or that all these specific moments in your script have to happen on these specific page numbers. It's ridiculous. And so some of those were well-intentioned, but I think they do not serve writers because it makes it look like there is this straitjacket that your script has to fit into, which is just not accurate.
And I think that's what's interesting about the book overall, which is something, again, analogous to a thing that we do at Second City. When we're going in and using these exercises to work with artists or executives, what I'm often telling them is like, hey, look, we're not going to be role playing. I know you think that's what you're going to be doing, but instead we're going to work on the skills you need to be successful in given moments. Mm-hmm. And that's how you do this. You break down, these are the moments you're going to be in with scenes. These are very specific things you're going to have with notes. And you just, in concentrating on the skills, it becomes useful as opposed to.
It does. And I think anybody who's been through any like psychological training or like how to deal with like trauma and things like that, you sort of recognize certain patterns and you're able to be present in a moment without being overwhelmed in a moment, which is improv. Also, improv is mostly listening and being very open and communicating what you guys can do together to create a moment that happens. So, the difference between someone who's doing improv and the writer who's like working on a scene is we're both trying to immerse ourselves in the reality of the situation that we're in. It's just that if you're a writer working by yourself, it's just you and you're all the characters and you're all this world and you're just trying to find a way to navigate this moment to achieve the goals of that scene. And it's a great process. It's exhausting. And I think I wish more people had experience that you're giving these executives is that the chance to figure out like how are you doing it, because what is it like to start from nothing and build a moment that happens in front of you,
because literally all of us are making something out of nothing. Everyone is every single day.
I mean every email is a wish. But it's just how you do it and honestly it's every email you need to be thinking about like how is the person on the other end of this going to be receiving it,
and
like
never think that.
No.
And they're going to look at it and go, what are they like? And you're like, well, you were kind of screaming at me. And then you say, was it all in caps? And you're like, no, I guess it wasn't all in caps. Yeah. Like there was that. So, yeah, of course. I'm curious, too, because the book features various guests you've had on, including Ashley Nagle Black, who is our great friend and my wife's student. But Chris Nolan says that writing is very hard and very lonely. Do you agree with that?
It can be very hard and very lonely. And listen, we have a mix of folks who've worked mostly in features and folks who've worked mostly in television. It's less lonely in television generally because you have a staff, there's people around you who are doing the same kind of thing that you're doing. And yet then you go off on draft and you are sort of there by yourself, imagining these things and making these scenes happen. Writing it's uncomfortable. And Ashley Nagle Black was on our podcast this last week. We did a live show. She's an amazing guest. And she was talking about sort of how, you know, people are tempted to use ChatGPT or something else like that to sort of get a first draft or get stuff going. And she's just like, from her experience as a teacher, you have to just become comfortable with being uncomfortable. You have to just know, like, this is going to feel awful and gross for a while because you have to get through it. And that's the reality of it all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let's talk a bit about movies versus television. You say, quote, for the main characters, the stakes in movies are almost always higher than they are in television. Mm-hmm. I had to take a beat with that because I'm like, oh, is that true? And I'm like, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, it's a thing I've realized over our 15 years of doing the podcast is that you think of like movies and television being like, oh, they're kind of the same, but a little different. But episode by episode, you know, hopefully you're pushing the story along in TV, but there's not that expectation that everything is going to get resolved. A movie story is a situation that happens to a character just once. Like they are fundamentally changed by the experience because it's way out of the ordinary. And television, whatever the ordinary is in your world, it needs to be within the realms of that ordinariness. And so, yeah, the stakes are just going to have to be higher. It doesn't mean like the world is going to end in every feature film, but the stakes for that character, for the hero, what they're going for, their transformation, it's going to be bigger over the course of a feature than it would be over an episode or even a season of television generally.
Well, and I think you describe this very well when you say, quote, it's very rare that you see characters in television burn down the house.
Yeah. Yeah, so burning down the house is a common phrase we use in screenwriting where at a certain point early in a story, you have disrupted their normal life so fundamentally that they could never go back to the way things yeah. were, and therefore they need to move forward. And you want the characters to feel like they have agency, that they're making choices that are pushing things forward, but also you as the screenwriter, you're making it impossible for them to go back.
Yeah, I forget which, I think it was a Spanish explorer did that thing where they burned down the boat.
Burned the boats.
Yeah. All right. So this podcast started when I wrote my book, Yes And, about how we take improv into these other worlds. And then I started working with a lot of behavioral scientists and did programs at the University of Chicago and Harvard and elsewhere. And a thing kept coming up which connected the worlds of improv and our industries and what they understand in behavioral science about success in life, happiness in life, and everything's about relationships.
Yeah.
This is the biggest, longest study they've ever done in the world with these folks who are now in their 80s.
Yeah.
It was all about relationships, and that is completely what you say about your work too.
Yeah. And so it's so tempting to think about, like, oh, this character is great. This character is great. But really what an audience is looking for is the relationships between those characters, because that's how you reveal characters, their interactions. It's what they value in each other, their moments of conflict, their moments of coming together. So charting the relationships is generally more important than charting each of the individual characters' arcs. There's this mathematical sense of, like, oh, you know, your protagonist has this arc and this kind of thing, and you have this antagonist, and there's supposed to be these opposing forces, whatever helps you. But really, you're looking at what are the relationships that the audience cares about in your story, and how do they evolve over the course of 2 hours or the course of a season of television.
You know, when you were talking about that, and you guys talk about Die Hard at different times, I was like, oh my God, every one of those relationships is fantastic. It's nuanced and layered, and some are new relationships and some are the old relationships. And I doubt anyone thinks of Die Hard as a relationship movie.
No. And that's what was so fun about doing a deep dive on Die Hard, which is the middle chapter of the book, is sort of, it's a chance to sort of apply a lot of what we talked about in the book, other places, to one specific movie. Those relationships make a lot of sense, and they chart really well. And it's, you think of it, Die Hard, as being a plot machine, but it's really very character driven.
So, improv has also suffered under here's the rules of improv.
Oh, yeah.
And in the early days of that, it was like no arguing on stage. And while I understand why that rule existed, people then sort of felt like, well, then you can't have conflict.
Yeah.
But you gotta have conflict. Like, conflict is essential. And you have, your chapter 5 is all about that. And I think it's also problematic, and you note this, because really, as human beings, most of us do not want to have conflict.
No. No, we don't. We want things to be, we want to get back to an equilibrium. We want everyone to be happy. We want to play peacemakers in situations. And one of the challenges of screenwriting is knowing that you need to make things difficult for your heroes, for your protagonists. You need to put them into conflict with other characters, with the world around them, with their own previous belief systems. That's uncomfortable. And I think, you know, comparing it to the yes and of improv, and it's the no fighting on stage, the no conflict, is you understand the instinct. You want to sort of, everything should be supporting this mutual vision of the story going forward. But that's also not reality. That's also not sort of how these individuals would function in real life. And so finding a way to weave that back through, I'm sure there's whole new strategies for that. Some of my favorite comedy recently has been sort of denying the premise of things in ways that feel destructive. It feels like it should be destructive and things could go off the rail. But in the hands of very smart performers, it really does work. I don't know if you've talked about this on the podcast before. There's a TikTok channel called Looking for Each Other, which is one of the recurring bits they have. They have two podcast hosts who have these conversations that are scripted, clearly, but it goes off the rail and sort of denies the premise of what's actually happening in ways that I find spectacular. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're Second City alums, because they are very, very clever.
Writing it down. Well, I think the Coen brothers movies are funny in that way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know if you, I don't know that everyone classifies them as comedies, but all Blood Simple Forward, to me, they were so laced with all that humor, but in a very provocative, interesting, dark way.
And I would say, like, you know, some of the Judd Apatow School and Seth Rogen and the folks who come through there feel very positive. There's also an aspect of not making things simple or easy for people, and sort of creating some conflict, or at least letting the attempt to lessen the conflict amplify the conflict. Tim Robinson, of course, again, like denying the whole premise of how everyone's supposed to be getting along.
That's funny. And so the little poster over there is one of the shows Tim Robinson did here, Southside of Heaven. Yeah. And I remember there is a scene where he was there's a hansom cab, right? And so another actor played the horse, and he had one of those noodles that you would see in a, you know, at a pool. Yeah. And he used it to whip the horse and just beats this horse because it's so loud, but of course it doesn't hurt at all because it's a noodle. But the audience is just on edge because they're seeing this horse get beaten. Yes. And Tim is so maniacal. And of course ends with him shooting the horse. And I remember this, like, actually watching him in the show, and I'm like, comedy is changing, mm-hmm. and the audiences are changing, and I'm seeing it happen with this very specific performer who has been like no one I've ever seen on stage at Second City.
Yeah. And I would say, like, Nathan Fielder is sort of not orthogonal, but sort of, like, you know, in a parallel kind of way, where it's just like being uncomfortable is at the root of the comedy, and sort of not letting people get out of their out of the conflict is important. So even at our live show this last Sunday, there was a moment of conflict on stage, and I had to sort of stop myself from, like, I don't need to fix this. It's not my job. I don't have to be the host at all moments. And so letting the conflict be out there, because it's interesting. It's the texture.
And it's different than the uncomfortableness of Albert Brooks or, mm-hmm. you know, like that school. It's just and this is what's interesting when you're around the industry for long enough. You're like, it's a shade of that, but it's different because
it is. Yeah. Case. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why I think it's important to do your research, sort of know the history of things and get a sense of the broad spectrum of things, but never feel constrained by what's come before you and follow whatever is interesting to you. And that's why there's the next generation of comedy. You can't predict where it's going to go. It's just going to find its own rhythms, its own vocabulary. I wouldn't have predicted that the physicality and the clowning that you're seeing in a lot of LA comedy. Yeah. I wouldn't have been on my radar 10 years ago. So
No, not at all. So it's interesting because my wife runs the first ever BA in comedy writing and performance at Columbia College here in Chicago. And so she actually does the lecture about the history and analysis of contemporary comedy, but it goes back through vaudeville and all that. When she shows the students now Ernie Kovacs, they lose their mind because mm-hmm. they can't believe how interesting and edgy it was. And that was so long ago. And I think many of those people end up on stage here, a high proportion, because I think the education at a young age gives you so much more to draw on in whatever your toolbox ends up being. And so, I mean, clearly you and Craig are students of the field that you're in. You grew up, what, were you a movie nerd, I would say?
I wasn't a huge movie nerd. It wasn't until I was in college, actually, that I really understood that movies were written, that there were such a thing as screenplays. Because you see movies like, there's movies. And I would read Premiere Magazine, and that was the only time I sort of saw, like, they're mentioning the writer here. And the first screenplay I read was Steven Soderbergh's script for Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which was published as part of, like, the production journal and then the screenplay. And it's like, holy shit, like, everything that they're saying was on the paper here beforehand. That's crazy. And I realized, like, I think I could do that. And I applied to film school and got into it. Now, of course, every screenplay you ever want to read for any movie is online, which is fantastic, because those we've recognized that those sort of belong out there in the world for people to read.
There's one more thing in the conflict chapter that I want you to talk about, because I think it's really useful for lots of different people to understand. So you propose that all fish out of water stories can be sorted into two categories, Splash or The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Explain how that works.
And you'll have the list in front of you, because I don't have my book open in front of me. But essentially, fish out of water is a sense of, like, you have a character who is in a place that they don't understand. Like they don't understand the rules of their world. Yeah. And in some cases, it is a Wizard of Oz moment where we as the audience have a similar lack of knowledge to how the world works. And so we are learning about this world with the characters. So they've come into a new world. Those are the Wizard of Oz movies. The Splash movies are, the comedy comes from the fact that we as an audience know what normal life is, and they are just an outsider who's dropped into this place. And so they don't have a sense of what this is. And so we are laughing, seeing how out of it they are. So that's Borat. That's, it's, endless number of movies, where you just have this innocent outsider who is trying to make sense of this world. Austin Powers, to a large degree, a lot of his comedy comes from his being a fish out of water in the modern era.
Yeah, I just think it's very useful, because, like, breaking that fish out of water, I think most people understand the concept, but that there is this other element inside, I thought was really cool. You say that, this is in chapter 8, quote, many screenwriting books will tell you to focus on what the characters want. This is wrong. Why is that wrong?
So there's a fundamental, one of the things you sort of come back to is, like, what does a character want versus what does a character need? And it's like, that's only useful to a certain degree. The idea that, like, they start with a want, but then they ultimately get to recognize their need. It's kind of a trap that you fall into, is that defining everything based on what the character wants and sort of how much they want it is, what's mostly crucial. What's more important for the reader and for the audience is to understand, what is the character trying to do and what is their motivation, like, in this moment in the scene that they're in, what they're trying to achieve with the conversations they're having, and to what degree do they think it is going to feed into the overall goals you set for that character. You know, one of the nice things about Disney musicals is they start with their I Want song, which sort of, like, clearly lays out the vision that the character has for their life. And so in non-musicals, you need to find some way in those opening few minutes to give us a sense of, what vision does this character have for their life? What might they be trying to do to get there? What will success look like for this character? And that's a lot of the struggle. So I think, you know, when I say, like, don't focus on what a character wants, it's trying to be, I don't know, a little bit more granular and mechanical about, like, what are they trying to do in those moments.
So this tied in for me to this aha moment I had when we were working with the behavioral science group at University of Chicago. And in improv, we have a keen understanding, and we teach it about being others focused. You really want to be others focused, and that, and it makes a lot of sense. And then my friend Heather introduced me to William Swan, who has a thing called self-verification theory. It's a little dirty, but it's cool. So the idea that Swan talks about is that most people think they want to be seen as their best selves, their prettiest selves, their smartest selves. Swan said that's not true. You want to be seen as you see yourself. So if I see myself as clumsy, I need you to see me as clumsy, so you won't throw me a ball, but I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, great. And
So this idea of, like, oh, it's deeper in terms of what, like, so the want is probably something else entirely. And you're going to ask, the only way you're going to understand that is by asking a lot of questions. And when I think about these great characters in cinema or television over time, it's that layer upon layer upon layer that gets revealed over a period of time.
Well, you look at Michael Scott as a character in The Office, and, like, the great conflict of Michael Scott is, like, he wants the world to perceive him as he perceives himself. He wants to be that person. He wants to be this thing that he fundamentally isn't. And that's what's driving a lot of the comedy there. And it's his need to be loved and needed and, not just respected, but sort of admired, is a great comedic, you know, inspiration. And so, and it's all those vectors. And we're talking so much about comedy, but of course, all of this applies to drama as well, which is, characters have this vision for their lives and how they want, again, back to relationships, how they want everyone around them to perceive them. And that's, understanding that is important.
You actually say earlier in the book, like, drama is really important for drama, but it's maybe even more important for comedy. And I'm paraphrasing, but I that's so true, because it's like, you know, you need stakes and you need pain. And all these sort of elements to get really great comedy. And I don't know that everyone understands how complex and rich that area is.
It is. And I think one of the challenges is, if we talk about stakes, and so often this, we think about stakes in terms of like, it's the end of the world, like it's disastrous, like the asteroid's going to hit the planet. And that's not stakes. Stakes for a character are, what are they worried about losing? What are they worried about gaining? Like, well, what are they going for, and how might that be ripped away from them? And establishing those are important for comedies, for dramas, for really any meaningful storytelling. If you don't have it, we're going to wonder, why are we watching? Like, why? What's the point? Especially in a movie where our expectation as an audience is that this is a transformative one-time event for these characters, or if it's not, that there are significant enough stakes for the characters in the moments that we're really curious to see what's going to happen to them next. My movie Go was my first script that got produced, and it's not the end of the world of this, and it's not the night that everything changed for them, but the stakes are incredibly clear for every character at every moment in the story.
I was just flat. So my first gig at Second City was as a dishwasher, and this is 1988, and mm-hmm. the other guy who got hired that week was Jon Favreau.
Oh, fantastic.
And we both had mullets, and there is photographic evidence of both these things. And I remember he was dating our mutual friend, EJ, who also worked at Second City. And I remember hearing this story about him leaving the messages on the machine. Like,
oh, wow, yes. For Swingers, yes. So
yeah,
crucial.
That absolutely happened. And I think it tells a story of a few different things, which is, and my wife is always teaching her students, he goes, try improvising based on a lot of true things from your life.
Mm-hmm.
They always improvise more interestingly because they're drawing from that. So that's something that John did. But also all the things that you're talking about happen in Swingers in terms of how that movie was set up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, like it's not the overall transformation of these characters, mm-hmm. but you clearly understand what everyone's going for in this moment, especially what Favreau's character is aiming for, sort of, and how much he wants to be perceived as something that he's not.
Right. And the world building.
Yeah.
That was very specific to that group and that time.
Yeah, exactly. And world building, we talk about a fair amount in the book as well, because people think about world building for like giant mythologies and Lord of the Ringsy kind of stuff. And world building is crucial for every kind of story, because we have to understand specifically what are the rules of this world, this specific world that you're building, which could be, if it's a hospital drama. Well, what kind of hospital drama is it? What is this? How does this hospital work? Like, what are the hierarchies? We need to understand these things and understand them really quickly in your story, so we can understand the stakes and the conflicts and what we should be watching for.
I love a good hospital drama, and I rewatched Saint Elsewhere recently, and I was like, oh,
it doesn't hold up.
No, it does hold up. It totally holds up. But what I thought was interesting is it's a completely different hospital drama than ER.
Oh yeah, night and day.
Yeah, night and day. Like, and that I think is why it was refreshing and interesting, because there was a level of incompetence happening in mm-hmm. danger that you would not see in a normal sort of hospital drama. Anyway,
well, Law and Order versus NYPD Blue. I mean, just like both New York police departments, but it could not be more different.
Yeah, no, totally. All right, in a moment I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, but before we do that, it is a weird time to be in our industry. And I feel very blessed I start, my first cast was Colbert, Carell, Amy Sedaris, and in the Turing Companies, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Rachel Dratch. Great place to start.
Incredible.
Out. Yes, exactly. 90s in Chicago, very good for comedy. And I'm finding a lot of our alums, more recent alums, are moving back. Now, some of them are moving back because they no longer take in-person meetings. And you guys have talked about that. Like, I just assumed that John August is going into these meetings in person. I think you said you've had like one.
Yeah, I've had like just since the pandemic, like one handful of meetings that have been in person. And honestly, I'm not mad at it. Like, it's no. I like sitting in my comfortable chair and doing these things. It can be nice to sort of be in the room with the people that you're actually hopefully working with. But yeah, I don't know. It's nice. Increasingly, it is possible to conduct most of your career outside of Los Angeles if you need to. It still is very, very useful at the start of your career to be in Los Angeles or New York, depending on sort of what you're aiming for, just because the casual connections, the people, your neighbors, the people you meet at the coffee shop, going out to a bar, you're going to bump into more people who are doing what you're trying to do. And that's incredibly useful.
Is there any other like advice you would give someone starting out? I think that's good advice. And it's advice I still give, which is like, if you want to get into the field I'm in, you got to come to Chicago and study at one of the places and do at least do your time there. Yeah. You're going to make your friends. You're going to find your graduating class, all that stuff. But, you know, especially in the world of sitcoms, they just don't exist like they did before. And the ones that when Harrison Ford is in, you know, your comedy, there's not going to be a lot of roles.
Yeah. No, it's a strange time for half hour comedies. And we're trying to figure out what that format even is. And so on the plus side, you also have many more funny people who in 10 years ago would have been in those shows who are now just funny people on Instagram and TikTok, and they're making their living at that, and God bless them. I hope that can be a sustainable career, and I hope that they can have a career in comedy off of that. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much faith I have in that in terms of someone is going to own the pipeline.
Yeah,
they always do. It's interesting in terms of my wife when she's teaching her students about where comedy is going. She's like, you got to understand where the money is and where it's coming from. So, you know, comedy clubs were mob run, so that you just need to not upset the mobsters. You know, radio, you were dealing with advertisers and television. When it started out was advertisements, then it became ratings. And so that, you know, that just changes. And I think the issue today with TikTok and these other areas where people are just putting up their content is you just know capitalism is going to move in and someone's going to own the pipeline and it's going to change the economics.
Well, obviously, I mean, we see comedy podcasts that are now going to Netflix. And so like these things, like you and I are filming this. And so, you know, 3 years from now, is this just a Netflix show? Who knows? You can't predict what it's going to be. But I hope that the kinds of things we're talking about on your podcast, on our podcast, and in the book, we're aiming for the more universal underlying truths behind this, which is that there's fundamentals of story that track across everything. And even as the industry changes, the skills that are involved in it are going to be the same. Notes on notes will still exist no matter what the format is.
Yeah, 100%. We always close the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I do have one. I was thinking back. So in 2007, I directed a movie with Ryan Reynolds and Melissa McCarthy and Hope Davis and Elle Fanning, this incredible cast, Octavia Spencer, great, funny people. And Ryan and I were friends. It was like, we should do something else. We should take a big adventurous trip, but just do a thing. And so it became a game of kind of... a lot of yes anding is just sort of a dare. Like is someone going to back away? Is someone going to step down? It's like, yeah, we should go to Africa. It's like, yeah, like we should go on safari, but we should also like go to some place that like, you know, it needs some spotlight put on it and do some humanitarian work. And so it's like, what's the poorest country on earth? And so we were just like ramping up and up. And so we ended up in Malawi, which is a tiny British landlocked country in Southern Africa. And working with this great group called FOMO, Friends of Melange Orphans, we're there for about a week, helping to paint this orphan center and put in a well and do things. And we were just the white people who were showing up and who were helping. And then in the years after that, we did some fundraising for them and helped them do more stuff. And it was a chance to sort of see that this was an organization that is all community run. It's the basically, after 20 years, the kids who've grown up in the system are now running the system, and it's self-sustaining and just great and beautiful. But I'm saying it's a yes and, because at every step, it was just like we were like on a hike. It's like, yeah, we should go take a trip. And it just escalated and escalated and escalated until it became this really great, beautiful thing that was an incredibly important part of my life, and it's been ongoing. But it was just a random sort of improv-y kind of, we could do this. And we were a situation of topping each other that brought us to Southern Africa and the little country of Malawi.
What I love about that is what we would call a bit turned into like a life-changing, like powerful moment for you.
I mean, there's a moment where like we're on the plane to go, like, wait, are we actually doing this? Like, is this really happening? But we did, and it was great. And it was a really good experience. And it was... You know, I've bungee jumped. I've, you know, skydived and stuff like that. But those are like one, it's a little one-time little burst moment. So this was like, yeah. Oh Jesus, like I've made a commitment to this bit here.
I love that. The book is called Script Notes, a book about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. John August, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Kelly, an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com. Or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.